You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm the RSA's Chief Executive. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here for this evening's very special event. And I'm delighted to be able to introduce this evening's guest speakers. We've gathered together two truly distinguished public thinkers to tackle a question that is right at the heart of the RSA's 21st century Enlightenment mission and our power to create worldview. Here at the RSA, we acknowledge that we are living in an age of uncertainty and disruption. Rapid social technological change offers the promise of greater freedom, empowerment and creative expression to expanding numbers of people around the world. And yet we can see that many millions more are denied access to the fullness of human flourishing. Across the globe, we continue to witness tides of conflict, of economic and social volatility, alongside increasing levels of inequality, vulnerability, atomization. So amidst this uncertain terrain, where do we then find sources of the kind of hope that can generate positive action and progress for humanity? To help us answer this question, we're honoured this evening to be hearing from His Eminence Cardinal Vincent Nicholls, Archbishop of Westminster and President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Cardinal Nicholls previously served as Archbishop of Birmingham from 2000 to 2009, and in February last year was admitted by Pope Francis to the Sacred College of Cardinals in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. A spiritual guide and leader to more than 4 million Roman Catholics in England and Wales, Cardinal Nicholls speaks frequently in the public sphere and was a key contributor to the development of an influential body of work on Catholic social teaching and the common good. After the Cardinal's opening address, we'll hear from Richard Sennett. Richard, as many of you will know, is one of the leading public thinkers of his generation. His work has always been guided by an intense interest in how individuals and groups make sense of their lives, the cities they live in, and the work they do. He's the author of a number of acclaimed books, amongst which are some of my favourite books of all time, The Fall of Public Man, The Corrosion of Character, The Craftsman, and Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. Richard has held several distinguished academic posts, among them University Professor of the Humanities at New York University, Distinguished Visiting Professor at the University of Cambridge, and Professor of Sociology at the LSE. So we couldn't really have a more powerful lineup to discuss the issues that we'll be facing this evening. So I hope you'll join in fully after we've had a conversation between us on the stage. But can you first join me in welcoming Cardinal Vincent Nicholls?
Matthew, thank you very much for those words of welcome and good evening, everybody. It's a privilege for me to be here and to be asked to share these thoughts with you. The title for this is, as you saw at the bottom of the stairs, Where Do We Find the Generative Capacities for Hope? And as we came in, my colleague John said, there's the answer. There was an arrow pointing upwards. But let me begin somewhere else. In the long and rather exhausting run-up to the general election, I was told of a researcher working in Essex, testing views and opinions. I heard that he had a hard time of the group he was interviewing because everything he put before them received a negative reaction. Eventually, somewhat exasperatedly, he put down his pen and he simply said, is there anything you like about Britain today? There was a long silence and then a man in the back row put up his hand. Yes, he said, what is it? And the man answered emphatically, the past. Now, maybe this is not the best starting point for reflections on hope, but at least it poses the questions. What, if any, are the places where we find hope? How do we understand that hope? How and where is it generated? What is the deepest nature of hope? Now, the phrase generative capacities appears in this talk's title because it seems to me that the capacity for hope is something which can grow and flourish in individuals and in societies. And it's worth trying to think around that central proposition. In doing so, I will draw principally on my own Catholic faith, as you would expect of me, a bishop. But paradoxically, part of a bishop's task is not to talk, but simply to be there as a reminder of the awkward questions about life. As someone put it to a colleague of mine, don't just do something, stand there. But I will speak, and I hope then we can follow with a lively and constructive dialogue. So what do I mean by hope? It's certainly not the same as optimism. Optimism, a disposition to whistle a merry tune, to look on the bright side, however irrational, whatever the state of things. Optimism may or may not be realistic. As a supporter of Liverpool Football Club, I'm beginning to learn those things. Hope is something else. The great philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas treats hope in two distinct but intimately related parts. He first presents hope as a natural passion arising from a desire for something understood to be good, though not yet possessed, difficult but not impossible to attain. So hope is a movement of the will, a striving towards such a future good, an appetite that stirs up confidence and grants assurance. So he says, hope abounds in young people and in drunkards. More seriously, hope moves us to become pilgrims. A hope-filled person is spurred into action when faced with something desirable yet hard to achieve. Hope is not the product of opinion or argument alone. There's a lovely phrase about the philosopher who knew all the arguments and for whom they had all grown cold. We do not acquire hope by having a point of view. There is something else, an impetus to act, a vision, something from within our understanding that fires our imagination, a drive consciously expressed to achieve a possible yet still future good. So hope is a partnership between both our understanding and our will. It moves us to get something done, something demanding, something that will make a difference. Hope gets you out of bed in the morning. The lack of hope leaves you reaching for the duvet. Understood in this way, our world is full of signs of hope. They surround us every day. They come in the daily strivings of people to establish, maintain, express, or consolidate efforts to attain something both desired and difficult to achieve. So no matter how fragmented our world might be, no matter how lacking in overall vision at present, there are countless fragments of hope. And what kind of fragments do I mean? They are precisely the experiences of daily life to which we find ourselves responding with warmth of heart, with a quiet smile of gratitude or admiration. They are a neighbour's kindness, a friend's compassion, the utter generosity of a lover, the creativeness of a gifted person brought to a good purpose, be it the generation of wealth or the work of charity. These stories do not fill our newspapers, but they do fill our hearts and encourage us. These fragments express the strivings of hope and are in themselves generative of hope in others. We can see well enough how each of them is a tiny masterpiece designed to strengthen a hope that in something indeed, something difficult will indeed be achieved. The relief of suffering, the faithfulness of love, the ending of poverty, the creation of new jobs or of new wealth. But what is more challenging is to see how these tiny fragments, as pieces of a mosaic, the tesserae, which when brought together can make a fine and inspiring work of art. I believe that this challenge of bringing them together is made all the more difficult, at least in part, by the culture of cynicism in which we live. This culture urges us to view with suspicion reports or even personal experiences of goodness. It tutors us to attribute to others the worst of motives, or at least to seriously question every motive. World weariness teaches us to be cautious. The misdemeanors of many institutions, my own included, emphasize that lesson. Nevertheless, we may have to learn afresh to see what is actually before us, the innate goodness of so many people. Another factor, may I suggest, making the formation of a coherent view of hope problematic, is our culture's embrace of relativism. By the logic of relativism, nothing that others do in pursuit of their hopes or ideals is necessarily related to me, since the notions of what is truly good or truly evil are privatized. That may be good for her, but it's of no interest or relevance to me. To nurture and benefit from the generative capacities of the hope we see around us, we may have to give more attention to these fragments if brought together, because they have the capacity to defeat both cynicism and relativism. Let me for a moment reflect on three aspects of our relationships which seem particularly important in thinking about how to assemble a larger picture, a picture of which we are all a part, and thereby a picture which strengthens the generative capacities for hope. First, the family. Our initial school of life and love is the family. We know now much more about the conditions needed for secure attachment and the bonding of infants. We know the powerful evidence for the lifelong consequences of early childhood trauma and dislocation. The experiences of healthy childhood development, including failure and forgiveness and the learning of gratitude, deeply influence our adult selves and our capacity for hope and trust in others. It follows that a society that cares about the quality of hope for the future will care hugely and in an objective and systematic way about factors which help or hinder the family. Second, beyond but founded on the family is what Jonathan Sacks speaks of as the social sphere. He describes this sphere as covenantal, always based on a kind of covenant that we make with others as we engage together in work or projects outside of the political or economic spheres. It is, he says, this covenantal activity that generates trust between people. In contrast, he says, effective political life and creative economic activity actually depend on trust, but they do not so easily generate trust. In fact, they often simply consume it. So this social sphere is crucial. It's the place where our identity as social beings, whose fulfillment is bound up with that of others, finds expression. But more importantly, it is the place, in this place, in this social sphere, hope is something carried by the community and not just by the individual. For a common project or a goal that is indeed difficult yet possible to attain, one week I may be full of hope and cheer you along. But the next week, your commitment and belief stirs me from my apathy and despondency. So thirdly, the imagination. I believe the capacity of art to stimulate hope should not be underestimated. A friend told me a story of a group coming together in a poor area of Bristol to hear about deep-seated social problems and the acute difficulties of effecting real change. Halfway through the meeting, there was a performance by a local choir, its members aged from 10 to 80 years of age. The effect on the meeting was dramatic. When the meeting resumed, the mood was wholly different. The choir's contribution had kindled in the group hope for what might be and invigorated them to act. These, I suggest, are some of the ways in which we bring together isolated fragments of hope into a wider and more coherent picture, thereby strengthening their generative capacity. The more we construct and contemplate that picture, which moves us towards a shared understanding of our common good, the more we are encouraged to seize some of the difficult things we know are indeed for that common good and we believe are achievable. But I would suggest, as a final point, we have to go further. Indeed, I suggest that both our experience and our reasoning requires us to do so. Take the experience of being moved by a piece of art or music. In it, we are taken out of ourselves. We move beyond the moment into something timeless. We reach for another horizon, an instinctive emerging sense of a cohesion about all things, a wholeness, or conversely, the challenge of radical meaninglessness. The ultimate invitation becomes clearer: radical hope or despair. This leads us back to St. Thomas and the second part of his consideration of hope. Here, he brings into focus the ultimate good towards which hope compels us, the mystery of God. Hope has, as its ultimate object, our radical happiness. And that happiness comes with our presence before and within God. Hope directs us towards God, the summit and source of all good, goodness itself. Understanding this enables us to recognize that among all that God gives us are the means by which we may attain this perfect happiness. So, for Thomas, the full description of hope reads thus: "Wherefore, insofar as we hope for anything as being possible to us by means of divine assistance, our hope attains to God himself, on whose help it leans." Now, this is what makes us truly pilgrims. Over and over again, we grasp that we are not yet there, still to achieve our true and deepest purpose. In the language of faith, this is the simple recognition of our creatureliness, the fundamental fact of the inner structure of our lives. Put it this way: if we are not creatures being loved into existence by a creator who acts with intention, then our journey is towards nothingness and our present without lasting meaning. God's grace infuses our natural hope, that stretching forth with a restless heart for a future good, difficult but possible to attain. God's grace infuses that natural hope with the imprint of its true purpose, one that is at the same time intensely fulfilling, yet truly daunting. Our home lies beyond us, yet our hearts and our reason reach out towards that home, and the gift of God makes it truly attainable. Such hope is at the core of contemporary Christian humanism. It drives Pope Francis to embrace the profoundly disfigured man, to kiss the feet of a Muslim girl, to harangue the ideology of global capitalism for its disdain for people, especially the poor, to proclaim ceaselessly that our reason for hope is the never-ending mercy of God, who pours out his life that we might see and live again. And all this is done in Christ Jesus. Now, in conclusion, there are many places in the world today where hope is in short supply. Recently, I visited Gaza to see the conditions in which over a million Muslims are held. I've been to Erbil to be with many, many thousands of Christian refugees there. But I would like to end with a short reflection I wrote after visiting the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. This memorial poses the questions we are considering in the most radical manner possible. Yad Vashem is a powerful tribute to all who perished in the Holocaust and a damning indictment of all who perpetrated it, directly or indirectly. On my visit, only slowly did these perceptions sink deeply into my consciousness. The journey through Yad Vashem is long and it needs time. I went without a guide with a small group of people, but quickly on its zigzag paths, I lost touch with my companions. In fact, I lost touch with everything, time, space, wider purpose. I quickly became absorbed in the horrendous story that was claiming my undivided attention. As I walked its paths, I had a sense of being drawn into a closed world, or rather, into an understanding of how the world systematically closed its doors to the Jewish people, leaving them to their dreadful fate. Never before had I understood how abandoned they were, left without any place to which to go or to call their own. I was drawn, too, into the personal horrors of the victims of the Holocaust, told and retold, city by city, family by family, until reduced to yet another corpse, brutally bulldozed into a pit. Never before had I felt in my deepest being the impact of the total degradation of the human person, executed on an industrial scale and here presented before my eyes. The questions flooded in, both at the time and afterwards. How could this have happened? What are the roots of this evil? What are its consequences for generation after generation of those who perished and of those who survived? How do so many of us now live with the guilt of being associated with its perpetrators or with its indirect participants or just its bystanders? Sin is a reality, and no one remains untouched by it. But does not this Holocaust of sin and evil demand that we stop any talk of human goodness and simply stay silent in front of its abyss, in which surely all hope is lost? Yet, even here are traces of enduring goodness to be found. They emerge in the indomitable endurance shown by so many in the Nazi killing camps. The last words of many spoken in the gas chambers were, "Next year, Jerusalem." Traces of heroic goodness are found in the lives of those who risked all to shelter Jewish people, who formed with them the powerful bond, that alliance of secrecy between the hunted and the protector. Sometimes in Yad Vashem, I had to read the small print to find these stories, but they are there. And today, this same heroism is recognized in the granting of the title Righteous Gentile to those whose stories of astonishing and astonishing courage emerge only now. There are indeed moments in which the small prints of the messages of hope seemingly disappear from sight. There are many when it does not. Ours is surely the task of keeping alive these rumours of hope, however we understand them, and of knitting them together so that the far horizons of an eternal hope may never be lost to our sight. I thank you for your attention.
Well, that was incredibly powerful. Richard.
Well, this is an amazing and moving statement of faith in hope. And I thought all I would like to add to it is a kind of contrast from another faith of what we make of hope, which is within the confines of Judaism, of which I am a believer. For us, the issue of hope is not as central as the issue of will in defining a moral universe. And I'd like to explain to you why, in our tradition, hope matters less in a way than will. What I have to say to you is self-evident, has nothing to do with religion as such. Think of soldiers who are ambushed or surrounded or whose position is hopeless and yet who keep fighting, who don't give up, whose lives are going to end, and yet they keep battling for something. In the Shoah, that is the Holocaust, as we call it, this is a central insight into what it meant to be a good Jew, to truly practice the Jewish faith, which is that under conditions of hopelessness, that there were still acts of help and compassion to others. That is, that it was impossible that anything would change. Everybody knew they were going to die. But the expression of religious faith, of being Jewish, was nonetheless to try and reach out and help other people, even though it was useless. And it's difficult to convey a bit to a Christian audience what that moral configuration is like. And I think the reason for that is that you have to imagine a way of believing in which there is no redemption, there is no resurrection. That is, there is no possibility of seeing a future as you would see it, in which something is transformed by the process of resurrection. Instead, in Judaism, there is something which is, in a way, a more brutal, as Hannah Arendt put it, a more brutal simplification, which is the will to do good or the lack of that will, without any hope for the future. It's a very, very different configuration for thinking about the meaning of doing a good act. There is no reward, nor I think in Christianity is there, for doing a good act. The act is su esse. But in Judaism, the notion is that if you perform a good act, it may be even so meaningless. And that was, and yet you do it. And that was, as Primo Levi said, that was the way to be Jewish in the Holocaust. It was meaningless, and yet you do it. The danger of this, and it's a danger in modern Jewish theology, which is much discussed, is that it makes arbitrary assertions of moral will come to the fore. You're doing something because that's what you should do. It's always said ours is a religion that leans towards relativism, if only. And it's what makes debates, for instance, within Judaism now about the behavior of the state of Israel so corrosive. For us, in these debates, the issue is not, and this may seem odd to you, it's not really whether the Palestinians are suffering, although of course they are. The issue is this the right thing to do? Is it right to treat others the way for centuries we were treated in Europe? Should we be treating Muslims the same way? That's a very black and white discussion, unfortunately. But it takes on its heat precisely because it has this religious overtone of being about the will to do good rather than the relativism of who is being hurt, how much are they being hurt, and so on. I guess I would say about this just one other thing. Because Judaism lacks the notion of redemption or salvation, it takes on, as, and this is not an original thought to me, it's the thought of the Jewish theologian Immanuel Levinas, it takes on an enormous emphasis on the relation between presence and moral action. That is, that presence here, now, is the domain of moral action, not the past and not the future. It's what happens right now. And in that sense, hoping for transformation is irrelevant to the notion of saying, what are you doing now? Is it what you're doing good? Is it bad? There will be nobody that is going to absolve you of doing a bad act. There is no absolution. There is no hope that that act could be forgiven. So this is a very, very, I would say, no, this is my own view. There are, our friend Jonathan Sachs would say we're not so fierce. But this is my own view of what makes the shapes the moral landscape of Judaism. One in which hope matters less than the issue of will. So that's, I think that's a discussion that we have. I just want to say in closing, are you really, you Brits really so hopeless about your own society? It's such a nice place to live. I've found so many other people. It can't all be in the past, can it? But in any event, this I think is a kind of, you know, this is a confessional divide on the relationship between the meaning of hope and will. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. So, Vincent, can I ask you to respond to that? In concrete terms, Richard's notion of what is there when there is no hope? That is to say, there are situations of no hope. Take, for example, the end of people's, the very end of people's lives, where is it, as Richard says, that this is to do with the hope of what comes after life, and that is what underlies the notion that there is always hope and hope's significance. So is there that kind of, does one have to be driven, as it were, by the possibility that something good will happen?
I think I'd like to start not by commenting on Richard's presentation of Judaism, because I wouldn't dream of doing that. But I sensed in his presentation a bit of an assumption that in Christianity the dynamic is the reward of good and the punishment of evil. And that wouldn't be my understanding of it. Substantially. I think that what lies at the very heart of the Christian faith is a vision of what it is to be human, and therefore, certainly, what it is to be redeemed humanity. So the notion of doing good in Christianity can properly be presented as being true to myself. So the good is good because it's good. So the good is good in itself. And therefore, I guess the space between us on that point isn't that wide. So a person, some of the Christian protesters in the Nazi camps would have behaved in the same way. They would have sought to maintain their humanity in the face of this assault, because their humanity is of God and therefore is good. Not so much, I believe, in the hope of an eternal reward, though that wouldn't be absent. So I think in that sense there's a further conversation that we could have exploring where we overlap, or as you said to me in the room before we came in, that Thomas Aquinas would have made a good Jew. Yes. I think, though, the second point, if I may, Thomas's view of hope is integral. And if you like, it has different dimensions. And it certainly does lead to our dimension of a belief in the fullness of life after death. Yes. So in that sense, he's saying a human person who might not share that faith is certainly not without hope. But a human being who may not share that vision, in his view, would be without the fullness of hope, because there is an integral relationship between these. And therefore, in the Christian faith, you come to that sense of redeemed humanity, humanity now able, through the action of God, to achieve its original purpose and no longer flawed by the encounter with evil, which we all enter sooner or later.
Is one of the elements of this debate, in a sense, to do with the ordering that things happen, action and hope? So there is a kind of a common sense assumption that we have, that it is hope that leads us to act. But I think, actually, when one looks at it, it's more often action that leads us to hope. It is by doing something that that hope is generated. The act of being the spectator, the cynicism that you talked about, is not unrelated to people's disengagement. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they adopt the position of the spectator rather than the participant. Mm-hmm. Richard?
Well, you make me think about something that's really not theological so much as artistic, which is the, or scientific for that matter, which is the importance of when we are looking at something, of failing in it. And if any of you are artists, or scientists, I suppose, would be the same thing. You know how central that experience is, of failing at something, anything. What a dead end. Now, you could say in a way that that has the power to provoke you to hope ultimately. But in the short run, certainly the experience, to me, the experience of limits and where you can't go is central to knowing where you can go. And that the experience of failure is critical to that. I don't think that, you know, being successful, therefore I hope, is, I don't think that's on.
I'm not saying that hope follows from success. I'm saying hope follows from action. But that is Richard's point is interesting in a sense. Is a capacity to welcome failure a necessary part of a capacity to hope?
I would say so, yes.
I
would agree with that entirely. Because accepting failure, accepting my limitations, I'm becoming more real. I'm becoming more realistic. And hope is not optimism. Hope is not a daydream. Hope is what is born in me from a grasp of what is good. Now, that grasp of what is good and can be achieved may well arrive through activity as well as through understanding. In fact, in St. Thomas's thought, all our understanding begins with experience and sense experience. And it's when we delve into the meaning of what we've experienced that we begin to conceive of what is the possibility here and what is the giftedness of what we can achieve.
Can we go from the sublime to the truly ridiculous? In the early stages of the Labour leadership campaign... A recurrent... I'm not asking you to choose a candidate. A recurrent theme was that Labour had failed to have a story of aspiration. Now, I'm interested in how you would distinguish the notion of aspiration as it is applied in that critique with the notion of hope. Is it merely that aspiration is selfish, is implicitly a kind of selfish individualistic, I'm not even say selfish, self-interested, an individualistic desire, whereas hope is a generous and more collective desire? Is that a too simplistic distinction between these two ideas? Because a lot of people's reaction to aspiration was, well, maybe that is what Labour needs to talk about to win, but it's not what you really ought to be talking about because it's a kind of selfish idea.
Well, I think your comment gets immediately to the limits of political activity. You know, so political activity is always going to be, you know, rather limited in its horizons. But there is a continuum. I do believe there is a continuum between what people aspire to for themselves and for their family, which is why I started with the family, and what people aspire to for the good of the common good or a more common good. And that pathway is a continuum. And I think, you know, part of the political dilemma that we face is, do you build from the individual, the family, or do you build from a more collective vision? I don't know what the current political climate would suggest, is that building from the personal and the individual through the family is a very, very important dynamic to people at the moment.
Richard?
Well, I guess I was struck by, just in terms of the discussion we were just having, you know, when you have a suffering or a limit or a failure, you have to give yourself time to dwell in it, you know? And I think this is a kind of, what politics doesn't do often is give people that experiential time where you can dwell in. I don't think Labour did anything wrong, but they did something that obviously
didn't work.
But it's the same thing with a moral failing too. We all fail morally. We're failing all the time. And what we need is the space to acknowledge that. You know much more about politics than either of us. The rush to get a new leader is like saying, oh, well, that didn't work, so let's go on.
Yeah.
It's like not opening yourself up to the experience of something which is failure.
Let me ask you about another cultural divide before I open it up to the room, Richard, which is a cultural divide between America and Britain, because it seems to me that in America, the notion of aspiration and hope is a kind of... There is a greater sense that this is almost your civic duty. It is your civic duty to aspire and hope, whereas we Brits are much more ambivalent about the idea of hope. I mean, if you're an American to say, I don't think I can become president of the United States, I don't think I can succeed, I don't think America can be the greatest country. This is a deeply kind of... I mean, we just say this kind of stuff as we walk down the street in Britain, but in America it's unpatriotic, isn't it, to admit to a lack of hope.
Well... I think that's the advertising on the box.
Right.
I did a study a number of years ago of white working class, mostly Catholic, people, families in Boston. And below in the box itself was an enormous feeling of being blocked, of not being able to have the lives they wanted and so on. I think what Americans often do is kind of tape over this feeling of kind of existential trouble. When F. Scott Fitzgerald said there are no second acts to life in America, that expresses a kind of deep, deep inner hurt that people have. But it's all covered over. A lot of it has to do with class, which is not openly talked about. I think in some ways you're a very healthy society. You know, you complain a lot. You're much more less boastful and so on. You know, people who are boastful who say it's all up, 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 there's something concealed in that. And usually it's a deep inner hurt rather than belief in yourself. So I'm really sorry that your Essex people felt that, you know, that's a wonderful thing to be self-doubting. It's the greatest gift you can have, you know?
Let's take some thoughts from the room.
My name is Peter Pledger. I'm a fellow and a governor of St. Mary's University. I feel that we're actually surrounded by people with hope. You see it every day, people who live in the most appalling accommodation in London, but then wake up and manage to go through. People who have poor jobs and know that they're never going to get much further. Carry on. If the test of hope is throwing off the duvet, then about 7 million people do it each day, and most of them are probably here. So we are surrounded by hope. And I think the reason why that is the case is that people change the paradigm. There's a popular film about the Marigold Hotel in India, and it said everything will be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, we're not at the end. I think maybe that's how we see life now.
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Seppi Gulzari Munro, and I guess this is really interesting for me, you know, mainly because I don't come at this topic with a religious framework at all. And for me, hope is very immediate, and it's a lot more actually, now that I've been listening to this conversation, become much more about the generative capacities of action, actually, and bringing it back to the point you made about labour. Actually, in the 1930s, the labour movement generated hope through action by helping dock workers get scholarships for their children to go to school, helping them find doctors. You know, it wasn't about the rhetoric that then brought people to action. It was about the action that actually gave people hope and generated more action. And I guess I just want to see a bit more of that in politics and in civil society, really, because I think we've become quite removed from the action on the ground. And I guess, how do we do that? Any suggestions there, how to bring action, the generative capacities of action, back into politics?
Yes, very briefly, my name is Mayor Hillman. I'm intrigued about the fact that so much of the discussion has focused, in effect, on the person and the need for them to continue, even in the face of hopelessness, to act in a moral way. The world is now faced with the most awful predicament insofar as we cannot now escape the fact that we are heading for climatic disaster through climate change. And in terms of moral behaviour, we have got to come to terms with it, although I've never heard it expressed before, that we are all contributing to this to varying degrees by our use of fossil fuels. So when one brings in morality, as you did, Professor Sennett, it seems to me that how do we come to terms with that? We are all complicit in this process, which is assuredly going to result in a declining habitability of the planet. And the proof of that is that there is now no way whereby we can reverse the process which is melting the ice caps.
Okay. So we have kind of three points. I think the first two, in different ways, look at this kind of relationship between action and hope. And then I think, if I can take, maybe you take your question in a particular direction, which is, isn't there a danger in some areas, like, for example, climate change, that hope is the enemy of what we need, because actually hope is the kind of sense that something might come along? you know, something might, you know, that's in a sense our position on climate change. It's kind of a weird mixture of resignation and kind of blind hope rather than action.
Well, I mean, my first comment to the third question is slightly tongue-in-cheek to say, wait till tomorrow. The Pope Francis issues a long document tomorrow precisely making some of those points, making them very forcefully, actually, and pleading for a hearing from across all the different communities and societies in the world. So he takes a rather unusual step of asking three people to present his document tomorrow, a Catholic theologian, an Orthodox speaker, and an atheist, to try and say, this voice, I hope, is something that everyone will listen to. And in a funny way, it relates to the second question, because he leaves himself some space vis-a-vis the scientific discussion and evidence, but he doesn't leave himself any space in urging people to act and to act together in a sense of solidarity, to say, yes, when we are willing to look at our own lifestyles, when we're willing to look at the complexity of some of the economic systems, when we're willing to look at the cultural and political context in which decisions are made, if we act together, then there is a reason to believe that this course of events can at least be slowed down or at least ameliorated in some way. So I would very much agree with the second speaker, you know, that the concerted effort that often has gone under the heading of solidarity is a huge and important source, a generative source of hope, because it brings into reach, into the realm of the possible, though difficult to achieve, that which up to that point has simply been outside of our reach. And you can see it in small communities based where I was as a young priest in inner Liverpool, where communities would organise and put pressure on the local authorities and get all the broken glass and all the mess off the streets and out of the park. And that generates hope without any doubt at all. But also then in the much wider appeal about the climate change, it is a call to action as a basis for realistic hope.
Richard, I'm interested, going back to your opening comments, on what do you think is the moral framework that we need in terms of climate change? Because we've had lots of events and discussions here. It is an incredibly difficult collective action problem. In some ways, it's very difficult to believe, to hope that your own personal actions will have any contribution at all. So is this an example of something where you simply have to have a notion of doing the right thing here and now, regardless of any kind of sense of its logical, whether it's logical, whether it carries hope, whether other people will do it, you just have to do it. Yeah. Is that our best hope, or is that just simply unrealistic?
Well, I don't think I'd quite frame it that way. I'll tell you where I think ethics comes into this climate debate. And that is that modern society has based itself on a notion of plenitude, of there being enough, of being able to add more and more physical stuff, to be able to produce more. And to me, all the issues that we're involved in with climate change, all the practical things we know how to do, aren't going to happen unless that moral mindset is reversed, and we are not only willing but anxious to have less. I mean, there is no way to say that you can deal with climate change and still do everything you want. It's to survive, we have to shrink how much we want, even to the I'd like to see cars, rationed. It's outrageous. It's an outrageous freedom. Limit on my freedom. Well, it's not outrageous if the moral mindset is one that I need less. So I'm afraid I don't agree with you. I don't think these practical policies are going to begin to bite until the moral climate is one not of we're faced with a danger, but that I will live a simpler life. I'll live with less. And as I said, the background to it to me is the notion that modernity, a lot of what we think of as modern consciousness, is about a cornucopia. Fill it up. Let's get an iPhone 6 Plus instead of an iPhone 2. It works better. So what? You know, it's always that kind of mentality that there's more. So I don't know. I've just I've done some work on climate change in cities, and I don't think any of it will matter because if you like, an ethical universe in which people don't want to recognize what the ethics are of actually using any of these particular tools that we have to reduce the climate destruction in cities.
So we do.
Can I?
I wouldn't. Maybe we are. Does it matter?
Vince, can I just ask you, because we've run out of time, just one last question, which is, I hope it's not an impertinent question, but I interviewed you a couple of years ago for a Radio 4 program about Catholic social teaching. And I said to you that, how did you feel about those people who were keen on the social teaching but not so sure about the Catholic bit? Were you kind of happy to have fellow travellers who loved the philosophy but not wanted to kind of stop at the God bit? When you look at the popularity of Pope Francis... Everywhere I go, you know, people say, oh, Pope Francis is great. But they don't necessarily seem to be thinking, well, if Pope Francis is great, maybe I need to be thinking a bit more about faith or, you know, whatever. Mm. I'm just interested in your kind of, you know, what it feels like to you to have a Pope who is so popular. and in a sense, whether it matters to you with this encyclical tomorrow, what does it... How important is it that we understand that his message comes from his faith? And it is, in that sense, slightly different from messages that other people might have about climate change that don't come from their faith. Is that...
Well, I was wanting to say to Richard, he's either read it or he wrote it, because your point is very, very central to this encyclical tomorrow. Very, very central. The whole point about wanting more and the impossibility of that as a way of life, and therefore for the radical change of a framework. Yeah, absolutely. I think Pope Francis would say, "Please just come along," and I think that stance would be actually quite deeply expressed in the work and the documents of, you know, what we call the Second Vatican Council, which really did adjust the course of the church. And, you know, the basic... I would say, you know, the basic commitment of the Catholic thing is to the good of humanity. And if people want to share that, then let's work together.
What a wonderful way to end our conversation. You should be a politician with that ability. So thank you all for coming. Thank you for your questions. I'm sorry I couldn't take... more of them. It's been a really, really wonderful hour's conversation. Just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Cardinal Vincent Nicol and Richard Sonnet.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.